Not now.
There we go. How about that? Good evening. So, Alaska was very interesting for me. In the fact that it is someplace I've always wanted to go to, it's a state that I had hoped to get to at some point, so it was a lot of fun to actually get a chance to get out on the trip itself. I had a fantastic time. We met some amazing people in our time there. We basically moved into Jay's house for the week that we were there, which was kind of fun because it felt like college all over again. So, I mean, six people living in a very small space and basically staying up to all hours talking about very interesting subjects most of the time. Alberto being very animated for most of those discussions, as always. But what I really loved in seeing all of the stuff and all of the people, I liked that the fact that it was still snowing. I liked that it was still cold. The worst part about coming back from the trip was the fact that I walked outside last Saturday and it was 88 degrees outside and I wanted to die because I had just spent most of the last 2 weeks places where the weather was actually more like springtime, which is something we don't experience here in Florida at all, in my opinion. But what I really discovered in working with the folks at Joel's place and actually hanging out with the kids that were there and just kind of watching people interact together was the fact that there was a lot of heart being shared with a lot of kids that really didn't have any place else to go. And when it was finally my turn or my time to actually get a chance to speak to folks, I wasn't really sure what I was going to talk about, even though I had written a lot of things down. We were talking about re-engaging culture, and for me, part of my background has the fact of being kind of stuck inside the Christian bubble for some time and kind of how that felt, and I can kind of see a little bit of that in some of what we saw while we were in Fairbanks with the different folks that we interacted with. Really just wanted to encourage them more than anything to kind of be out and working with people where they were. Meet people where they are inside your context. There are certain things that we might be able to do, that I might be able to do, that somebody else won't do or is not gifted to do because they have something else that's going on. So, but more than anything, when I was talking to him, and the second night, a lot of the folks who were in attendance at the conference were people who actually worked at Joel's place. And I felt more than anything that they needed to be encouraged in what it was that they were doing. We encourage each other all the time, or hopefully we do in faith. That's part of what we do when we get together in church meetings and when we hang out outside of here. Anytime we get together, encouragement is a big part of that. But when you're doing something that doesn't seem like anybody else is on board or behind in your community to a great extent, which is what I kind of felt when we talked to the folks at Joel's place, was that they didn't have a lot of support in the community that they were in. Because, I mean, let's be honest, it's a skate park, and while that might be more normal for where we are in Florida, skateboarding, surfing, people out on BMX bikes is pretty normal. It was a normal part of growing up in this area. In Alaska, it may not be quite as common as it is here. So for them to be running that community center, and that's what it really was. It wasn't just about a skate park. It was community center. Those kids were coming there because, honestly, they didn't really have a whole lot of other choices of places to go hang out and be kids. More than anything, just to get together to hang out and be able to be kids. I would have given anything to have something like that when I was growing up. And I mean, a kid, just to be able to, after school, go someplace and ride a skateboard or play video games or talk to people and just hang out in that aspect. My mom worked when I was growing up, so after school, I went home. I had two siblings that I took care of. I'm more than, you know, whatever. We're only a few years apart, but that was part of life. But you can see some of the discouragement when they think that, you know, the community doesn't support us all that much, and the Christian community that we're a part of isn't sure how to support us, you know. And when you sit there and you worry about, are we going to have enough money to keep the doors open the next time? Are we, you know, is this going to work out? For me, it was just to look at them and say, what you're doing is good. If it matters to one kid, the amount of time that you spend, if it matters to one kid, then it's all worth it. I can think of one kid, George, in particular, that hung out with us. Every night that we were there, he was there. Talking to everybody and trying to get to know people and hanging out. And I can see how, if they have to deal with him all the time, that it might be, you know, it's like any time where you have a kid that's just kind of there all the time hanging on you. But you know what? George felt like somebody loved him, you know, which I don't think he probably felt when he was at home because he was always at Joel's place by what everybody said while we were there. that makes a difference and that matters. And that's what I really felt like they needed to hear. Plus, it's a very transient, Alberta talked last week, Fairbanks is kind of a transient society because most people who are there are only there for a short amount of time, or they grew up there, but they can't wait to leave because they don't want to be in Alaska. They want to be someplace else. So the other part of it was kind of hinting at some of the stuff that Tommy talked about when he was here last, about, you know, you have dreams for a reason. You have these good things that God has given to you, has put on your heart. Don't be afraid of those things, even if it's not something that seems like something that you should do. If it's something you want to do, is something you feel you're good at, you should do that. I told them one story to kind of bring a point home. It's a story that I tell my my classes when I teach at work, having to do with the fact that what we do matters. And I tell my students at work I tell them the story for two reasons. One is to talk about call control because it's a call center, and unfortunately we have to be off the phone in a certain amount of time. But the other piece of it has to do with the fact that the people that you're talking to, they sometimes need somebody to talk to. So I'll tell you guys this story too. When I was taking regular agent phone calls when I first started at eBay, I was taking regular agent phone calls for sports. And I got a call from a guy named Chris. And I talked to Chris multiple times over the course of about a month. He would call often. And by some stroke of genius, even though it's really hard to get the same person multiple times when you call them, I talked to him many, many times for that. And Chris was very much interested in baseball. He would call the MLB.com shop line, and we would talk. And he was always really good. He wasn't like some of these others that just call with random things. He had done his homework. Chris had spent time on the website. He had items that he was interested in. He had things that he wanted me to look up for him. And so we would spend the first couple of minutes, and he would say, "Well, I'm looking at this T-shirt. What can you tell me about it? I want to buy this jersey, and I need to know if it's on sale right now. Hey, I saw this T-shirt last week, and I wanted to know if you guys still had it." He was very good at that. But then the conversation quickly became, "So what did you think of the Tigers game last night?" And I'm not a huge baseball fan. I like baseball. I prefer to go see baseball played live because I can't sit through it on television. It bores me to tears anymore. Although Laura's dad probably would have loved to speak to this kid because he is a Tigers fan, and I am not. Even as a baseball fan, I'm always going to root for the Mets, which sometimes is sad. But so I told Chris after a while, "So what did you think of the Tigers game?" And, "Hello, Chris, let me Google real quick and see what the score was last night." And I would talk, so he would, "What do you think about Cabrera? How's Cabrera's season going to be?" And we would talk. What I garnered from those conversations is that Chris just wanted to talk to somebody about baseball. And there was a part of me, the work part of me is like, I need to get this guy off the phone because somebody's going to start asking me questions about why I've been on this call for so long. But the rest of me is just sitting there going, this is incredibly sad for me. It really hurt, really hits me inside because all this kid wanted was somebody to talk to him about baseball. He didn't have anybody else that he could go to in his life that he could just sit there and talk about the Tigers. And they call centers, they call us because we technically have to talk to them. We can't just put the phone down and go away. We're not really allowed to do that. But more than anything for me, I knew at the end of those phone calls that he was happy. Even if he only got to talk to it for about 5 minutes, he was happy that somebody would relate to him for a few minutes, even for a sport that I really don't care that much about. So my encouragement to them was the same thing. It's like, we don't know what our impact is on folks when we talk to them. Never devalue the amount of time that you get to spend with somebody. Never feel like you didn't, you can feel like you didn't get enough time, but never feel like it didn't matter to somebody, because we don't always know how much the time that we've spent with those folks really matters. And I really felt like that's what they needed to hear too, and I need to be reminded of that all the time, because there are lots of times when I just go, is this conversation ever going to end? But it matters to the person that I'm with, so I need to be in that moment and be with them in that regard. So Alaska was a lot of fun. I had a great time. I had a great time in Seattle when I left. That's a different story. But Alaska was very cool. If you guys get a chance, and with some of these other trips that come up, I encourage you to, if you're able to go, you should come. You should go.
Awesome. I don't have a good story like that. So you guys could just go home and meditate on what Dave just said. What he said, yeah. Call centers. No, it was really interesting. I found out probably like a day or two after the conference that at the session that Dave and I spoke, there was a young man who had never heard anyone preach the gospel in his life, ever. And he was there and saw that for the first time and heard that and experienced that for the first time, you know, and I was just kind of sitting there thinking to myself, like, wow, you know, like, wow. There are people in, you know, we like to think sometimes that, and even the way we define sharing the gospel has changed and evolved over the course of time, but that someone could say, I have never heard someone share about the heart of God, or I can't even begin to imagine what that process looks like, you know, and to hear someone say that, like, just kind of took me back, and I was just sitting there, like, I always interview people that I find to be different, or that people I've never met. I'm like, so you never heard anyone? Like, I just wanted to, like, track this kid down and ask him a million questions. But I just thought that was absolutely amazing. And like Dave said, as we get more and more doors opening up, you know, our team kind of a lot of times look at these things and say, is it something, you know, that I should go on, or we should just send a group to be a part of that, and just really encourage that aspect of the church, that each and every one of you guys have something to give to the global church, to the church at large outside of sort of our sphere of influence. And that one of the unique things is that we have a DNA that is directly connected to us, that we feel is common, right? Like, we see the beach, and that's just normal. It's normal that there's a large body of water full of creatures and monsters that can come on shore. Like, that is right there. That's normal for us. And for them, it was the Northern Lights. That's normal. That, like, the sun is launching electrons at the earth, and they ignite in our atmosphere and dance and make noises. Like, that's normal for them, you know? And what you begin to realize is that you get to carry your DNA to places that what you have is rare. Absolutely rare. Something you are, so we see it in the natural when you visit third world nations, you know? You have something that's so common that they don't have, yet you discover that they have something that you don't have. And so you're drawn to that, and you grab that, and you grab it, and you want to bring that with you. And so, you know, that's always kind of the thing that I always encourage people is, you have something to offer, you matter, you can contribute to something far larger than you ever imagined by simply by experiencing God and existing. And then God's desire to draw that into someone else. So, yeah. Definitely be praying for us. We have more and more doors open. We've got stuff opening up for next month and the month after that, and we're always praying, like, strategically, like, okay, which ones do we do, which ones do we not do? One of the unique things we started doing is, of course, bringing people with us so that they can be new points of contact for different cities and different kind of areas. I would love it if everybody in this room had one city that they're just like, that's the place I'm connected to, you know, and I go there every year, and I minister there, and like, this small little church has this large impact in this huge area. I believe that that's what Paul's intention was when he, in the book of Acts. So, one of the questions I'm always asking myself, I ask myself a lot of questions. So, one of the questions that always seems to come up, I want to be accurate. I like the term precision of language. You know, try and be careful and say what you mean. You know, mean what you say. And so, one of the many questions I always ask myself is, why do I do what I do? Or why do we do what we do? In any circumstance I find myself in, you know, why did I say that? Like, where did that come from? Or, you know, maybe that's just sort of my overthinking, insecurity, kicking into high gear. But I'm always sort of evaluating things. And I do that because, for me, I think why helps me discover what my form is, right? Like, we always look at a why question, and it provokes us to discover information and develop a structure to respond to the why. Why did I say that to my, you know, my daughter? Well, at the time, I got frustrated, and I was frustrated because this has been my experience in the past, and the way I've seen that dealt with is this way, so my automatic form is to respond that way. And then suddenly, it's like, wait a minute. Is that okay? Does that make sense? Like, the why always causes you to investigate what your true form is. To me, it's sort of like the tide that washes away sort of the temporal, you know, sandcastles that we build in our lives. These things that, you know, look beautiful and look like they make sense, but they fall apart so easily. And it leaves behind, to me, the building blocks of things that will last, things that will make sense for tomorrow. You know, to say, why do we take up an offering? You know? I remember when we, a few months ago, maybe it was the end of last year, we were looking at the differences between tithing and offering and saying, why? Why do we do that? What is our intent when we, you know, write a check or donate money? Do we believe in the tithing model of 10%, you know, or do we believe in generosity and saying, give as your heart desires and as you feel the Lord, you know, lead you? We're more concerned for your time and energy, which you're always welcome to sign up to something in this church. So, that's sort of, to me, it's kind of like, it could sometimes feel like what we're doing is trying to build something new when we ask a why question and we come up with sort of like a novel idea, like maybe we should do this. It almost can come off as like, you know, oh, they're just trying to come up with a new idea or something that's trending or, you know, something that's, you know, that's appealing to someone's eye. But to me, it really is a genuine effort to ask the Holy Spirit, is this what you want? Why questions to me have always been, is this what you want? Was this your intention, Holy Spirit, when you started this work? Or did somewhere in there, like, I get involved and put myself in it, or someone else got involved, like, I was that kid that asked why questions growing up. Why this? Why that? Why this? Why that? Like, it was always like, why are we doing it that way? I don't understand, you know? And always sort of those why questions, and I always got that, because, I told you to, you know, or whatever. And I remember seeing this little kid at Bizarro's Pizza one day, and he was asking his mom a million why questions. And this poor mom was trying to keep up, and you can tell she's putting on a genuine effort to answer every question he's asking and giving him the information he's looking for. And she's just like tired, and he keeps going. And I could feel sort of the tension growing. And before I walked out of the restaurant, I just went up to him, and I'm like, keep asking. Seriously, keep asking. The mom's looking at me, and I'm like, and I told him, I'm just looking at this kid. I totally interrupted their conversation. I'm like, one day you'll find out, and everyone will ask you. Because you were the only person that asked. You were the person that tried and investigated and thought about it. You were the weird kid that wouldn't stop, you know. But you found out why. And somewhere in there, you discovered the heart of God. To me, you know, Proverbs, that verse that says, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter and the glory of kings to search it out. And you've heard me say it, you know, several times before, that to me, I find it so awesome that Solomon identified kings as people who searched out things that the Lord hid. They're the ones that looked for it. When Jesus describes looking for the woman with the lost coin, that she looked for it until she found it. You know, that desire to know, to me, looking at that little kid. And I remember, like, saying that to her. She didn't get mad at me. She was like, yeah. Okay, next round. You know, like, suddenly she realized that what she did had meaning, had purpose. It was significant to sort of, like, figure those things out and answer those questions. And so that, to me, is why I always ask why. And you will see me ask why. You know, I understand it's annoying among our leadership to go, I don't know, I just do it. Like, why are you asking? See, why question. You know, like, why am I asking you why? And so among those things, I just this week, with some of sort of these things that have kind of been laid at our feet as a church and new ventures and opportunities that are opening up, with more people kind of inquiring what we're about, I just kept thinking about, why did we start City of Refuge, right? Like, why do we meet? Why do we gather? What is sort of the core of who we are? I'm sure for some of you guys, it's like, I don't know what I would do on a Saturday night. I've been doing this for so long. For other people, it might be like, well, I feel obligated, you know, like I would be shunned if I didn't show up. And you would, so keep coming. No, I'm just kidding. So maybe that's partially true. No, I'm just kidding. And so a lot of kind of a lot of what we discovered in sort of our transition with not just leadership, but even our name change, when we went from Elysium to City of Refuge, there was a lot of questions of who are we? What are we about? What is our expression? What is our community? What are the core values that exists in our community, and how will we honor that value system that the Lord has entrusted us with? How will we value the people that he brings, whether they become permanent parts of our community or they're just in our orbit? How do we influence? How do we develop? And so some of the things that kind of just really popped up to me, and I'm a picture person, right? Like, I love the Old Testament. I really do. I remember, like, when I first got saved and started reading the Bible, I went through the Pauline letters because it felt good just to start something and finish it. I'm like, dude, I'm really cracking this out. Like, Philemon, that's just one chapter. Done. You know, next book. But, like, really, reading the Old Testament, like, the stories, the pictures, like, for me, I was filled with questions. Why this? Why that? You should have seen my Bible. It was like, I got to ask this one to my youth pastor. Why this one? Why, you know, because I loved the paintings of what God was communicating during those periods of time. And so, among our many things that we stand for, I wanted to share a couple with you guys, just as we keep this at the forefront of our minds. Whether you're in leadership in our community, and we've got a ton of you guys, like, really, like, that's, we love that. You know, we love people who love to facilitate community. And so, you know, something to keep that, you know, as you minister and as you do your own thing, or whether you guys just take this as sort of a model of how you want to build something, you know, take it or leave it. One of the things I think initially that was always a part of our hearts was to see people encounter God. Like, I know that sounds simple, but we wanted to see people encounter God, be changed by him, and go do something with that. Like, that was always kind of like this weird thing we had. And I know we can say that as sort of a, well, sure, every church wants that. But a lot of times, especially in sort of the phase that we are in now, it is at our own detriment. We don't retain people well because it's so easy for us to go do your thing. Like, no, now that you get it, now that you've experienced it, go do your own thing. And one of the verses in the Bible that I think, or stories that so beautifully illustrates that, is in 2 Kings 5, if you guys will read with me. Go ahead and unlock those iPhones. Can someone give me a cup of water so I could, like, really go for another 45? That'd be awesome. Thank you so much. And if you guys don't have a lot of lights on the corner, we can have these lights turned up more if that helps. Would that help anybody? No, it's fine. All right. Just don't fall asleep, that's all. So 2 Kings 5, it says, "Now Naaman was a commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given him victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy." A lot of good, huh? Being a valiant soldier and your very strength is the thing that you feel is being taken from you. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel. She served Naaman's wife, and she said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So the word of God and who God was and his character and his nature had gone out that we serve a generous wife. So that we served a generous God. As you were. So they had gone out that the people of Israel had a God that responded to the prayers of his people. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means," the king of Aram replied, "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, 10 sets of clothing, and the letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter, I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes, what a reaction, and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went from his horses and chariots and stopped 7 times in the Jordan. I'm sorry, did I skip something? This is what happens when you trust your computer. That's awesome. So, heard the king of Israel to where his goes. Then Naaman went from his horse and chariots, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, go and wash in the Jordan, click, 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. But Naaman became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, strange river names, the rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Now before I continue reading, quick recap. The presence of God is in Israel. He's healing and moving in people's lives through his prophet, but that goes largely unrecognized. And any effort from any nations around them who are considered enemies trying to investigate this God was considered as a hostile action. There are times I look at the way the church responds to things that are happening around them, and I'm just like, it's not a hostile action. It's people genuinely seeking the heart of God. They just don't understand it. But we sort of interpret like, oh no, the world is coming to an end. That's it. America's going down. You know, it all is lost. And so I love how beautifully Elisha orchestrates this, not to go out to this man and present himself as, I am the prophet that you have sought out, but putting his faith in his words and saying, this is what you need to do, and trust in this God that in this process, he will heal you. And we will pick up where I actually have it on my computer. So Naaman's servant went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you to wash and be cleansed? So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant. So his thinking is challenged, like, what's up with this river? Why would this river heal me? We've got better rivers at home. This is stupid. And the servant saying, does it matter where you bathe? If he had asked you to jump 20 times and sacrifice 50 camels, would you not have done it? So is it a big deal that you put your faith in this process and watched yourself be healed? And now Naaman violates what Elisha tried to do by maintaining distance, and he goes directly to him with all his men, thanking him in gratitude and begging to give him the treasures he has. That is an attractive gospel that people don't run away from feeling like, I don't want this, but are willing to sell everything, give all that they have out of a gratitude that they have at seeing a God that responds to them. The prophet answered and said, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. He said, no, I don't want your gold, man. Like, I give you freely what he has given me. Let him be honored and glorified. If you will not, said Naaman, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. Is that not repentance? That is not something Elisha told him to do. But this guy says, no, this God is real. What must I do? Like, what can I do to continue honoring him? But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down and he is leaning on my arm, I have to bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. And Elisha responds with, go in peace. You notice that Elisha's response wasn't, hey, you should join my church. Hey, you should join my small group ministry. It would be really awesome, and we could really do something here in Samaria. It'll be great. You, me, and we'll get a bunch of my friends, and we'll do a Greek study on all these words that happened in the Old Testament, and then we'll get a worship team together, and then we'll have this awesome, like, light show, and people will come, and then we'll have bulletins, and then we'll have, like, all these, like, small group gatherings, and then we'll incorporate and become a 501c3. He said, no, take what has been given to you and go home. Go to where you have been called. Go before that king. Honor him. Serve him well, but honor the Lord and let him see that. You see and I mentioned this last week, I believe, you see the man in of Ganaria who was demon-possessed, and he was chained up to a rock, and Jesus comes, and he heals this guy who's been this violent, you know, demon-possessed dude, and the guy goes, I want to follow you, Jesus. And he says, no, go into the city and tell them of what the Lord has done. He instantly releases this dude to do ministry. That's awesome. And I'm not downing seminary school. I'm currently working on my master's. But I will say, Jesus did not go, hey, I got a couple schools you can sign up for. And after 5 or 6 years of serving in those ministries, you can start an internship at your local church and do that for about 8 to 30 years until someone dies and you can finally lead it. Or he says, no, go. Go and tell them of what the Lord has done. There's authority and power in that. It is always, to us, I think, has been as we begin to ask the why questions, one of the conversations we had is about sort of developing, you know, people and releasing them into their calling and their destiny and supporting who they are and recognizing that people will make mistakes. I'm sure Naaman went back and made a ton of mistakes. I'm sure he was not an expert at this Jewish God and all the things that he has done and the lineage that he has supported, but he got to know this God and experience him, and that the gospel could be preached in Aram to the king of Aram that would largely not be done because it was closed off to the rest of Israel. You only went in as a captive. Will we trust the Holy Spirit to do the Great Commission and accomplish it? Will we be a people that know a very real God and can introduce that God to other people and say, hey, this is the Holy Spirit. Enjoy. Watch them fall over. And go, cool. You know, and go on to the next thing. Like, will we be a people that say, hey, I believe in what you have. I don't care your history. I don't care your past. And we want to release you into what you're doing. I had a friend of mine who was in prison. He gets saved, he starts reading his Bible, comes out of prison, and just starts gathering people together to just to pray and worship together. And within a short, few months, he had 50 people in his living room. Awesome. But very quickly, he was seen as a competition. And very quickly, the accusation of the heresies he taught and, you know, how crazy the things he was teaching and how unseasoned he was, and no one said, let me mentor you and help you. It became a battlefield of like, who's right, who's wrong. Then to go, that is awesome that the Lord will take anyone, doesn't matter, and will elevate them and raise them up, and he will launch them into their calling, into their destiny, and all they have to do is exalt his name. Done. Because like Elisha, it's not about me. It's not about him. I had another friend of mine who was struggling with pornography when he was in college, and started a small Bible study with him and his roommates just to address this issue. And next thing he knows, he has a bunch of people showing up to his dorm. Is that not the God that we serve? And so to us, like, the idea of building the Titanic of church ministries has always seemed counterproductive. Where I always wonder if God's intention was to have an armada. All of these ships, you know, covering the sea, you know, an army that is orchestrated by the Holy Spirit, where men's egos don't matter. Where we have to serve along each other's side or none of us will survive. Where there is a dependency on togetherness, where there has to be community. One of my favorite stories I remember reading in summer school, in high school, I did summer school like 2 or 3 times. It's terrible. Like, why I'm in ministry is beyond me. But I remember we went through the Iliad and the Odyssey, and I thought it was so cool that, like, and if you've seen the movie Troy, this will work. You can use that as your reference. I thought it was so awesome. Yeah. I don't know what technology these days, what's cool anymore. So do kids read? Is that still in? Okay, that's in. All right, cool. So it's kind of like Divergent. But more like, okay, now? All right. I'm not down with the lingo anymore. So I remember thinking it was so awesome that you had Agamemnon, who had his ships, and then you had Ajax, who had his ship, and then you had Odysseus that was on his ship, like Achilles, he's on his ship, and they're all rushing to the sea of, you know, to land in Troy. And like for Achilles, it was all about his honor and his glory. So he's telling his men, row faster, we're going to hit those shores and get, and you're just seeing, I'd imagine for Troy, it's like, what? Is there a party? Like, is this a surprise for me? Is that why everyone's here? You know, it had to be this daunting reality to know that this massive army, and we forget, Troy was a part of Greece. But we say it was the Greeks versus the Trojan because the Greeks, you know, the armies of Greece had gathered together and had excluded Troy, and they were targeted. You know, and so it's this, to me, it was always this beautiful picture of like, man, what the church can do as this unstoppable army of these independent tribes coming together, honoring one another and honoring who he is. So that's a very long side point. I am so sorry. I will probably do it again. Challenging people's thinking in their modes of ministry. One of our big things was just, again, with the why questions. It's like, should we do it this way? Like, how many elders should we have? Like, is there like a science to that? You want like 4 elders to every 10 people? You know, how many pastors should we have on staff? Kind of looking at sort of modes of ministry and how things work. Even missions, right? You know, how many banners should we have in our sanctuary of ministries we support? You know, I remember when that was like, I don't know if that's still cool to do, but I used to visit churches and they would have all the banners of all the ministries they support. You know, how much should we give to our missions? And kind of asking all those questions. And then really being convicted and saying, what do we believe about ministering to people? What do we believe that actually looks like? You know, when you think of missions, it's always going outside of your community to serve someone that exists outside of that. Whether that's in Africa, or whether that's in downtown Melbourne with the large homeless population we have. It's fulfilling the Great Commission. And one of the awesome pictures of that is in Acts 28. This time I'm pretty sure I've got like the right set of verses. It starts off with once, right? Maybe not. Okay, now. That's cool. So I'm reading from the NIV. So for those of you who have that, it will be easy to follow. For those of you who don't, I am sorry. Starting in verse 1, once they were safely on shore, we found out that the island was called Malta. Quick background, Paul is on a ship on his way to Rome. This is towards the end of Acts. And so he's making his way to Rome. This ship has gone through this horrific storm, and it's capsized. And they didn't know if it was Paul's fault or whose fault, like why God was angry that he would cause the ship to capsize. And so they land on shore, and they discover it's called Malta. And the islanders showed us in unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was rainy and cold. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. And when the islanders saw this, the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, "This man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, the goddess Justice has not allowed him to live." It's a pretty serious accusation. I mean, they throw their false god into it. The goddess Justice is after Paul. But Paul shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no ill effects. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall dead. But after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said he was God. What a theological debate that must have ensued at that point. The god Justice is trying to kill him. Okay, maybe not. Maybe he's God. Someone needs to explain the snake bite thing. You know, like, I mean, they're struggling, and their theology is somehow getting thrown into this thing. You know, it didn't turn into an Obamacare debate of, you know, what was within his network and what wasn't. It was interesting that it's sort of the focus maintained was God angry with Paul, or was he in fact God? And here Paul is, who's just like, oh, this guy. Yeah, he follows me around. It's awesome. Like, you too can get bit by a snake and not and survive it well. And there was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island, and he welcomed us to his home. Notice the word us. Welcomed us into his home. This is one of the indicators that the book of Acts was actually written. This is where the debate comes in about whether it was Luke or John Mark, but either way, that the person, the disciple writing the story, was physically there and present. You notice the book of Acts shifts in the very beginning, kind of just like food for thought. The book of Acts starts with them, those people, those guys, and then during certain missionary journeys, it goes, and we, and us, and then I went and did this. And so you get to see the first insight of like someone physically being there telling the story. Sorry. So he welcomed us to his home and showed us generous hospitality for 3 days. His father was sick in bed, suffering from fever and dysentery, but Paul went in to see him, and after prayer, placed his hands on him and healed him. When this had happened, the rest of the sick on the island came and were cured. They honored us in many ways, and we were ready to sail, and they furnished us with the supplies that we need. Again, here you see Paul going on a journey. His intention is not to go to Malta. Not at all. I'm sure he probably would have picked the quickest route to get to Rome. Who wants to be on the ocean seasick for that long, right? I remember a homeless guy that I picked up one time said something that always stuck with me, and he said, "You'll never meet the people that are walking if you're too busy riding." And I remember thinking about that. In a society of efficiency and effectiveness, I need to go to Vieira, so I'm going to take 95 because that's the fastest route to get up there. And so we look beyond, like, the people around us. Does that make sense? We can be so, I can't tell you how often I'm not even present where I am because I'm thinking about the next thing I have to do or the next place I need to go. Or I'm not thinking of what will the Lord freely do around me no matter where I am. The idea is like, no, I have to go somewhere else to serve and for God to show up. And here you have a guy, Paul, who gets, poor guy, gets thrown into this, you know, he's going to prison, right? Like, he's on trial, and he gets put on this island and gets bit by a snake is the first thing that happens. And he's like, whatever, like, the God of Israel goes with me, like, no problem. And everyone goes, what? How are you alive? What an amazing ministry opportunity. Well, I'd love to tell you. I'm glad you asked the why question. Like, how, why did this happen? How did this happen? And yet Paul gets this amazing opportunity to address their theology. To me, I have discovered that for everyone, no matter who they are and what walk of life they come from, any emotional struggle that they have is a theological issue growing underneath. How often do we see God get thrown into something that you thought had nothing to do with anything, right? You know, or religion get thrown into something that you're like, because deep down inside, I think that undertone of who is this God, what is he like, always exists. I can't tell you in how many settings I find myself meeting people in unexpected situations where I'm having coffee with someone and an opportunity opens up. And it might seem so small and so minute, but to take that opportunity to go, let me share the word. And here he gets, you know, he's starting this fire and it opens up this door to this conversation of people asking, is he a God? Is God after him? Then it opens up the door to the local governor to come into his home, and it continues. And he prays for his sick dad. And then suddenly the island, the entire island's bringing people. And again, what was the response? Take this gospel away from us. We don't want to hear anything else. Or man, please help the villages. They need to hear and know about this God. Here, let's give you money and stuff. Take it with you so that we can continue funding this thing. It's the natural response to a gospel that I believe is totally attractive, regardless of what people say. Maybe the way we say it, maybe the way we share it may come off as unattractive, but the gospel of hope in life, and you continue to see people like Paul and Elisha, and not to say that there aren't going to be people that are out there that are going to outright reject it, sure. But I see a gospel that actually offers hope in life. And when people actually hear it, they change. That's why, like, it bothers me sometimes when I hear people say, oh, you know, regardless of the generation, they don't want to hear the gospel. They're closed off. Or those people over there, they just don't get it. The Muslims are closing their ears. They'll never hear it. Sure, with that attitude. Like, what are you sharing if you actually believe that, right? What are you telling them? But then how often do you meet people that get to minister to Muslims all the time? I told a story a few weeks ago about a friend of mine who's working in Egypt, and he was working out there, and over there, everyone has to have a religion. Like, you are asked the question, what religion are you? are you Muslim? Are you Christian? What are you a part of? And for an atheist to go in there and go, well, I'm not part of a religion, is like, are you crazy? Like, are you not part of a community? Like, do you not have a belief system that you're tied to other people? Because it's so meaningful. And the opportunity to share the gospel is astronomical. And so to me, you know, here's again another case where God is just using Paul to challenge modes of thinking and ministering. It's challenging the idea of their gods. It's challenging what they believe about God through God's faithfulness in Paul's life, through Paul's willingness to give of his time and go, all right, this is going to get real messy. It's what I said a couple weeks ago. We don't realize that if you look at Acts in the context of how it's developed, and then you look at all the Pauline letters in the context of when it was written, people were getting saved faster than proper theology could be taught. It's why the letters existed. People are just getting changed and transformed. And then when you read the book of Revelation, when the letters to the seven churches, in there you see issues being addressed. Because these people suffered with Jezebel. Because these people listened to the Nicodemons. They continue to address the issue of bad theology being stirred up in a culture of people getting saved left and right. But the concern of these apostles was to raise up sons and release them into their calling, into the destiny, and to challenge those modes of thinking within those cultural contexts. And so for us, like, that has been an identity of that. Like, do we actually believe this? Like, can we qualify those statements? You know, when we say the Lord works in mysterious ways, what do we mean by that? You know, is that a way to placate a question that someone just asked? Or is there a response to what's being asked of us? You know, I was struggling with the whole, how many of you guys saw the Bill Nye and the other guy? The whole creationism versus evolution. I can't tell you, man. And for those of you who are familiar with the band As I Lay Dying, they were this Christian band that did a lot of evangelism, and the lead singer ended up going to prison for trying to kill his wife. Yeah. And he tells the story of how he had been reading on the road during, you know, the days leading up to this, all these atheist writers, these intellectuals like Dawkins and Stephen Hawking and all these other people that were writing all these stories and challenging Christianity. And he said the way he felt was like there was no one willing to stand up for Christianity and actually offer facts and truth. And he goes, and he was so bothered by that. He's like, I don't understand. If we believe in this God of truth that knows everything, all things, is full of wisdom and knowledge, and we believe in a guy like Paul who writes in Colossians that you would be full of wisdom with all understanding, we say statements overused like, I don't know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. You just have to have faith for that. Than to say, we serve a God that wants to answer the why question. I would love to tell you. And we know that that's the kind of God that we serve because we see a guy like Job who was not a first century Christian, who did not have complex understanding of Christianity, and God goes through a 4-chapter dissertation of the speed of light, the way the cosmos have been developed, weather patterns, and all the animals that exist and how he created them. And Job, who could not understand anything that was being said to him, is like, I don't know what's going on right now. Like, I don't know what you mean or what you... I mean, there have been scientists over the last 100 years that have been able to look back at the book of Job and verify the statements that were being said in Job. Thousands of years before we ever even begin to look at the fact that DNA could exist in blood. Before we began to consider that light is not measured by distance, but by the time it takes to travel distances. It's not measured by length or width. Before such a concept could have been conceived, you see it in the writings of Job. And it was, and I remember he, you know, reading the article that the lead vocalist of As I Lay Dying saying, he's like, man, I wonder, like, where were the heroes of Christianity that really understood these things and could respond to these guys? Or did we become so entangled with, I don't know, the Lord works in mysterious ways? Sorry. That's one of my modes of, like, if there's, like, a sacred theological cowl that I just want to cast down, is this, like, helpless response to what the world has. It's to challenge those modes of ministries, to work with engineers and technicians that are super intellectual guys and can explain the gospel to a whole population of people that, for the rest of us, we'd go, I don't even know what to say to them. Like, I don't know half the statements they just made. But we serve a God who celebrates those things, that loves to challenge the way we view ministering to people, that loves to take those things and make them simple, and to say, I was walking in a large crowd of people, and a woman touched my cloak. Where's the theology in that? Well, I believe that that guy's a man of God, and I believe that if I touch him, he'll heal me, because he's merciful and he's gracious. Well, that's enough. That's good. Cool. Awesome. The Lord God will respond to that. Where we sometimes, I think, make it so complex, like spending time in Alaska, I realize that. It's so easy to go, we're here to do a conference. How do we make it the best conference ever? We'll get people from everywhere. Than to just be. Like wherever we were, whether we were around homeless people or wherever, just to be and to have our eyes open to the way those things work. And how often those trips challenge the way I view ministry and missions. It's like, wow, it's not the way I thought it was. It's not taking my Americanism and injecting it into another culture. That's crazy. It's not American imperialism at its finest. No. It's service and letting God be God. Sorry. Second rant I need to apologize about. And we'll look at, I'll skip through this next one, but just because I did feel this deserved an honorable mention, we have, for us, like one of our ways of ministries that we've kept at the forefront of the way we minister is through prophetic ministry. I'll explain what that means. If you notice, a lot of times during our worship services, Alicia or one of our singers will just kind of go into this time of just sort of what could be defined as freelance singing, you know? And during those moments, they're asking God and asking the Holy Spirit to say the words that he wants to sing over people. To not just go and work through these songs from verse, chorus, verse, you know, breakdown back into the chorus, build it up for the finale. But to say, okay, Holy Spirit, what are you saying right now? What are you doing right now? Because as a church, we believe if there's a gift that God is releasing it back into the church body, especially in this country, is prophetic ministry. I was working with a group of pastors, and they were talking about people being healed in the Philippines. I think it was Philippines or Thailand. One of the two. Very different countries. But it was one of the two nations. They were saying, man, it's so awesome to go over there and see people healed. I wonder why that doesn't happen here. They're like, maybe we need more faith. Maybe we need, and I kind of like paused and pondered that, you know, like that question. And my response to the guy was just, maybe God has gifted us doctors and hospitals and is releasing another gift of his spirit for a purpose or an issue that we have here. I said, in a country that suffers from high suicide rate, from a lack of identity, from a people who take medication just to keep their heads together and their hearts together, to in a nation where we see relationship models torn apart, where we see family units completely taken apart, isn't prophetic ministry so appropriate to exist in our time and in our culture? For a people to hear through your mouth what God thinks about them. Like, wouldn't that be the appropriate thing that God would gift our nation? He says, I'm not worried about healing. You guys have all these doctors. You know what I'm worried about? Do your kids know that I love them? Does that person on suicide watch know that my heart is for them? Sing those words, because that'll be greater than anything else. You see, Jesus say that to the lame man that was lowered down by his friends from the roof. You guys remember that story? They destroy this man's house. Like lower this lame man on a mat, and he says to him first, your sins are forgiven. That's what this dude needs, like his sins are forgiven. And of course the Pharisees are kind of like murmuring among themselves, who is this man who can forgive sins? Why would he do something like that? And of course one of them stands up and says, has there been an appropriate sacrifice for this man's sin to be healed? And he challenges the model of thinking. And he goes, I can forgive sins. But so that you might believe, get up and walk. And he validates who he is and challenges a pharmaceutical thinking that it had to be through an animal being sacrificed. But he validates his position as a son of God and heals this man and forgives his sins. And so to me, it was the calling out. He knew that what that man's heart was after was to be reconciled with God, that we would serve a God that gives us his words to speak and declare to people. So you'll see prophetic ministry models. And if you want a picture of that, 1 Samuel 9, when Samuel calls Saul to be king of Israel through prophetic ministry, and he says to him, I knew you were coming. God told me you were coming. I prepared a table for you and I to eat. You're going to sit with me. And then he says, and tomorrow I'm going to tell you everything that you need to know. And Saul's like, what? I'm just here to look for my dad's cows. Have you seen them? And he goes, don't worry about his cows. Other men have found it. You'll find out in about 10 minutes. What? And then the servants show up. Oh, yeah, your dad's cows were found. You ready to go home? And he's like, no, I got to talk to this guy, Samuel. And then the next day, Samuel takes time to sit with Saul and says to him, when you leave, he's going to change your heart and you'll be a new man. And he's going to transform your life. And you're the man that all of Israel has been waiting to be king. And you'll be crowned as king. Follow him all the days of your life. And it says that Saul walked away as a changed, a new man. We remember the end of Saul's story. But we forget that he changed and became the person to rule over Israel because a prophetic man called out the gold out of Saul's heart. Called him for who the Lord saw him to be. I'm sorry, I understand, and this is going to frustrate a lot of people who listen to our message, but I haven't given up on President Obama. I know that sounds crazy, but like I pray for the man because in my mind, wouldn't it be amazing if God transformed his heart? How many Christians would get saved? I believe in the God that saves. I can't believe that happened. Him of all people. And it's like, yeah, him of all people. Why not? Why not? That his latter years are better than any of the four, than his previous ones. Like, wouldn't that be amazing to see that and believe that? So we believe in prophetic ministry, and that's an aspect of who we are. And then lastly, because it's like 7:53, and people are going to like in the back going, bring it home. Bring it home. I appreciate Jacob. Jacob's so patient. Like, he's our sound guy. He can't go home until I shut this mic off. And every week, he sits there patiently going, I've got kids. I'm like, I got a business to run, and this fool won't shut up. He could have said that in half the words. In Esther 6, and again, I'll just sort of, you guys can read this on your own. I had hoped to, like, spend a lot more time with you guys, but maybe that's what I don't know, lunch and hangout time's for. In the story of Esther, there's this, in chapter 6, there's this really unique story of Mordecai, previously in the chapters, had overheard a plot to assassinate Xerxes. And he tells Xerxes about it. Of course, he goes to the proper people and he says, hey, there are these two guards and they're wanting to kill the king. You need to do something about that. And so those guards get captured. They confirm that they had this assassination plan. But it's forgotten that Mordecai did anything. It's just long since forgotten. Haman continues with his plot to eradicate all the Jews that were living in the area. And so he continues with this plot. But God did not forget what Mordecai did. God did not forget that Mordecai honored God by serving Xerxes well. He did not forget that Mordecai didn't sit there and go, man, if Xerxes gets killed, maybe we can get a new administration to come in and yada, yada, yada. He said, no, I'm going to honor the king that the Lord has set before Israel, even if it's at our detriment, even if Haman pulls us off, I'm going to honor Xerxes. And so in the story, one night, King Xerxes cannot sleep. The Lord will not let him sleep. And he's up all night and he just can't sleep. And so he comes out of his bedchamber. He sits on his throne. And he asked the attendant to start going over the chronicles of everything that has happened in his kingdom. That's a pretty serious thing to do at 3 o'clock in the morning. I usually wake up and read a book, you know, like a fiction novel at 3 a.m., where this man wants to hear everything that has happened in his kingdom. And so he gets to the part about Mordecai revealing that there's this assassination plan. And he asked the attendant the question, what did we do for Mordecai? And he says, according to this, nothing, my lord. And Xerxes says, we need to honor this man. We need to exalt him and elevate him for what he's done. And so, as the story goes, he calls Haman into his presence, and he asks Haman a general question, not realizing that Haman is against the Jews. And he says to him, what should I do for the man that honors the king and is prized in his eyes? Haman, in his arrogance, thinks that Xerxes is talking about him. And he goes, oh, for that man, I would give him the king's robes and his best horses, and I would parade him among the nation and show him that you have supported him and you are for him. And Xerxes is like, that's really good. And Haman's like, I know. And he goes, cool, go get Mordecai because I totally want to do that for him. Wait, what? Mordecai, that fool? Like, why would you? Yeah, he really helped me out and saved my life, and I want to honor him. What's the Lord do? He exalts Mordecai. He says, because you elevated me and who I am and exhibited my character, even among a Babylonian nation, because you trusted me to be your salvation, man, I'm going to elevate you. So for us as a church, like, I hear it all the time. Like, we make choices sometimes that seems to be at our detriment, right? Like, why would you financially invest in that? You guys are broke. Why would you guys serve that, you know, over there? That doesn't even make sense for your expectation for growth. You know, why would you guys shift your modes of ministry? How will you ever get numbers in your church? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? Because we believe, like Mordecai, that if we exalt him, he'll worry about us. If we honor who he is, and we're not worried about how grandiose our service is on Saturday, and how do we expand our budget for 2016, or how do we get to more missions next year, and not to say that we aren't responsible with those types of issues and concerns, but our heart is like, if helping out this couple launch into their ministry will exalt God, then keeping them and getting their numbers, cool, let's do that. Let's do that. May our names fade from the whole equation. And may he be exalted. May he be known. For us to, you know, release missionaries, you know, when Brandon and Carrie, who are now serving in his mansion, when they came up with their idea to go up there and serve, you know, sure, we're losing one of our biggest supporting churches, our, you know, people who helped found this community, but it was like, but to go and serve there and start community, that's awesome. Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. May we be a people in whatever context that you're in, that he gets exalted before yourself. May he be celebrated. May we, I mean, one of the things we've even began to talk about is how do we support, you know, in a cultural context where people are leaving General Assembly of churches, large churches, and you're seeing a larger trend in micro ministries being launched and in small group ministries growing. How do we honor these people that are searching and seeking for community rather than trying to capture them to fill in our seats? But to go, no. Does it mean we launch more small groups? Does it mean, and this is something we've been working in the last year, does it mean that we identify leaders outside of our church and say, how do we help you do what you're doing? We want to add to you, not take away. So that God may be glorified in our community, so that more leaders can be successful, so that there are more harvesters for the harvest, even at our detriment, at our finances, like even at that, cool, let that be done. Because like Mordecai, let the Lord be exalted, let his character be known. Like Paul, let his favor be upon us, and people see the life that he dwells with us. Like Elisha, may the nations know that there is a God in America and that he's active and he's moving and he's saving lives. Because right now, Australia has declared a 7-day fast for our nation. That's how concerned people are. May we rise up and be that community. May, like Samuel, we call out of people's lives the kings and queens that exist in our community, so that we can see them celebrated and elevated, that we might call out people into their destiny, into who they are. Thank you for bearing with me to the 8 p.m. mark. And if you guys will stand up, I'd love to pray for you guys. I know Dave is talking about doing Jersey Mike after.